Imagine trying to capture the absolute fury, you know, the tension and the electric hope of a monumental political revolution. But you have to do it following one incredibly strict rule.
Right. And it's a constraint that goes against, well, basically every instinct of political expression.
Exactly. Zero people in the image. None. Absolutely zero. You can't paint a single face screaming in the street. You can't show a flag waving. You can't, like, show a massive march or police in riot gear.
Yeah, you essentially have to tell the story of a monumental social uprising using only rusted roofs, leaning brick walls, and, you know, the heavy shadows of a sunset resting on the side of a mountain.
Which is wild, because when you think about historical political art, your mind immediately goes to action. It goes to human faces.
Absolutely. Taking that away strips the narrative of its traditional main characters. It leaves the viewer kind of searching for the story in the infrastructure itself.
So today in our deep dive, we are going to discover how one specific painting managed to trap the entire essence of Colombian resistance inside this absolute deafening silence. We're exploring a watercolor piece by the artist Jaro Duque titled Homes in Salo,
which depicts a very specific neighborhood in Cali, Colombia.
Right. And our mission is to uncover how this artwork transcends being just a pretty exotic postcard and instead uses empty architectural structures to symbolize immense community resilience, youth activism, and collective hope.
And we have an incredible set of source materials for this exploration, which makes it so exciting.
Oh, it's so good.
We aren't forced to guess at the artist's intentions or, you know, project our own theories on a canvas. We have the artwork's official technical sheet. And more importantly, we have Duque's personal, highly detailed analytical notes.
Mapping out his exact historical and emotional intent, it's essentially a treasure map directly into the creator's brain.
A literal blueprint.
So for you listening, I want to invite you to use this exploration to look a little bit closer at the everyday information around you. We're going to see how silence and empty buildings can sometimes speak a lot louder than a riot.
To really unpack this, we first have to look at the physical materials used.
Yeah, okay, let's unpack this. Because to someone casually walking through a gallery, they might just see a colorful stack of houses on a steep hill.
Right, just a pretty landscape. But the artist's technique actually directly mirrors the rugged physical reality of the neighborhood itself.
The medium is the message.
Exactly. The materials are incredibly specific. According to the technical sheet, this is a watercolor painted on Arch's 300-gram cold-pressed paper using Daniel Smith pigments.
And for anyone who doesn't paint regularly, that cold-pressed paper is a really crucial detail.
It really is. It has this highly textured, rough grain. So imagine a miniature topography on your desk, full of tiny microscopic peaks and valleys.
So the surface fights back a little bit. It isn't like painting on a smooth piece of plastic or drawing on an iPad where every line goes exactly where you tell it to go.
Not at all. Because of those tiny peaks and valleys, the water doesn't flow smoothly or uniformly. It pools in those microscopic crevices.
The paint just kind of does its own thing.
Yeah, the pigment flows in unpredictable paths, dictated entirely by gravity, the amount of water, and the friction of the paper itself.
Wow.
As a watercolorist using this medium, you lack absolute control. You just cannot micromanage the paint. You have to work alongside the accidents and the resistance of the paper. You adapt to what the material is giving you.
Which is such a brilliant analogy. If you look at the actual geography of Silo, the neighborhood itself was built exactly like that watercolor pigment flows, out of pure adaptation to a rough, unforgiving surface.
Yes.
Silo was built on a steep, escarped hillside out of pure necessity. The builders, I mean the everyday people, they didn't have a blank, perfectly flat, paved canvas to work with.
Right. They had to deal with the gravity and the irregular terrain on a daily basis.
Yeah.
They were just carving out space wherever the mountain allowed it.
And Duque explicitly notes that he rejected what we call academic vanishing points for this piece.
Because in classical art, an academic vanishing point uses neat mathematical lines converging on a horizon to create a perfect illusion of depth and order.
Right. And he just threw that out completely.
He had to. Because the reality of Silo completely rejects that kind of neat urban planning. It is an architecture born of survival and necessity, built brick by brick without a master blueprint.
You know, the analogy that kept coming to mind while looking at the piece and reading the notes is a human coral reef.
Ooh, I like that.
Right. Think about how a coral reef actually forms in the ocean. New coral polyps build their homes directly on top of the calcium skeletons of the old ones. They lock together. They build layer upon layer to withstand crushing ocean currents.
That is exactly what it looks like.
In this painting, The precarious leaning houses of Siloe look just like that. They are physically propping each other up. If you pulled one wall away, it feels like the whole mountain would just slide down into the valley.
It really does. And that physical structure perfectly mirrors the social structure of the community. The neighbors have to physically, economically, and emotionally prop each other up just to survive the currents of extreme daily precarity.
Yeah, they are deeply interconnected.
And the artist's color palette reinforces that exact idea of a living, grounded organism.
Huh.
You won't find artificially bright, pastel, tropical colors in this watercolor.
No theme park vibes here.
No, not at all. He deliberately used deep earth tones, rich ochres, dark blues, and intensely heavy shadows.
Those shadows give the buildings incredible weight.
They anchor the buildings to the mountain. They prove that this isn't some flimsy temporary settlement or a cheerful tourist destination. These deep, heavy tones give the architecture permanence. The visual weight communicates that these homes aren't going anywhere, even when the next storm, whether meteorological or political, hits.
Here's where it gets really interesting, though. I have to push back on the context of how this was made.
Okay, go for it.
Because while the painting depicts this visceral, heavy, sweaty reality of Cali, there's a detail in our sources that really stands out. The technical sheet says this piece was finished in January 2023, but it was painted in a studio in Whittier, California.
If that is true.
That is thousands and thousands of miles away from the dangerous, highly complex reality of a hillside in South America. Isn't there a massive danger here of romanticizing poverty from a very safe, comfortable distance?
That's a really valid question.
Doesn't he risk disconnecting from the urgency of the streets by painting this in a quiet studio in California?
It is a fair concern, and frankly, it is the eternal dilemma of diasporic art. Diasporic art involves artists creating work about a homeland they no longer physically inhabit, which always carries the risk of nostalgia or romanticization smoothing over the harsh realities.
Hmm.
But Duke's own personal notes address this geographical tension head-on. He clarifies that Whittier, California, is merely where his desk happens to be right now.
It's just a location.
Right. He strictly positions himself in the notes as a direct witness to what he calls the warrior spirit of the people of Siloe.
So he is claiming a deep, lived expertise. This isn't a landscape pulled from a Google image search to look profound.
No, not at all. It's a memory born of a highly embodied personal experience with the extreme poverty and the structural difficulties of the area.
And because he has that lived experience dialed in, the geographic distance might actually function as a creative advantage rather than a hindrance.
How so?
Almost like a microscope. I mean, walking through a dense, bustling neighborhood like Siloe, your senses are going to be absolutely overwhelmed.
Oh, for sure.
You'd have extremely loud music thumping from a window, motorcycles roaring past you on a steep incline, the smells of street food and exhaust, a million individual conversations happening at once.
That's sensory overload.
Exactly. It's so chaotic that it can be hard to see the big picture. By retreating to a quiet studio in California, he essentially filtered out all that immediate deafening noise.
Oh, I see what you mean.
He stopped looking at the individual moving parts and could finally see the whole cell breathing as a single collective entity.
That is a great way to frame it. And that deliberate focus is what creates the painting's very unique atmosphere. The watercolor features this crepuscular dusk lighting.
Which feels very specific.
It does. Duke describes it in his notes as a suspended time. It represents the dense, highly charged silence that happens either just before or just after a massive action.
Like the heavy air in a room right after a screaming match?
Exactly. Or the deep breath you take right before you sprint.
A silence you can cut with a knife.
Which brings us back to the monumental absence of people we talked about at the beginning. The neighborhood doesn't need a single individual face painted in the windows because its strength is entirely collective.
The people are already there.
Yes. They are visible in the asymmetrical brickwork, in the makeshift stairs, in the leaning balconies.
Mm.
The houses themselves are the fossil record of human resistance.
And that heavy, suspended silence isn't just an aesthetic choice made in a California studio. According to the sources, it is the direct precursor to a very real, very loud historical explosion.
Absolutely.
Which brings us to the core political narrative of this artwork, because the silence in the painting is hiding a massive amount of tension.
To fully understand the art, the context of Siloe is required. For nearly two centuries, Siloe has been an incubator of popular resistance against profound inequality in Colombia.
A long history.
Right. And the artist's notes specifically highlight the crucial role of youth activists. These are young people who have taken the destiny of their neighborhood and, frankly, their country onto their own shoulders to demand structural change.
Duke describes their movement as pushing a progressive, democratic, and deeply human perspective.
Yes, and all of this historical weight came to a head in the 2021 social uprisings in Colombia.
A massive movement.
A huge social explosion. Thousands and thousands of people, largely driven by these youth movements, took to the streets, demanding an end to systemic poverty, police violence, and massive inequality.
The social uprising was a defining generational rupture. It was loud, it was violent, and it fundamentally altered the political landscape of the country.
What's fascinating here is how the art responds to that.
Well, yeah, what does this all mean for the artwork itself? If the direct inspiration for this piece is the fiery 2021 uprising, full of tear gas, riot shields, burning barricades, and massive crowds, why filter all of that out?
It seems counterintuitive.
By intentionally not showing the young activists on the front lines, doesn't the artwork lose its punch? Doesn't it soften the harsh reality of what these kids actually went through?
Well, the artist knew exactly what he was doing by leaving the literal fire out of the frame. If you paint a literal representation of a protest, you know, the painted signs, the clashes with police, the shouting faces, you run the risk of creating a mere propaganda poster.
Oh, interesting.
A literal image tells the viewer exactly what to think. It leaves very little room for profound reflection. By hiding the visible fire, Duke instead paints the subterranean pulse of the neighborhood.
The subterranean pulse.
Right. When you don't see the flames, you're forced to look at the precarious leaning structures and ask yourself why these buildings and the people inside them are so incredibly vulnerable in the first place.
It brilliantly illustrates the dry wood before the fire. You're looking at the systemic conditions that made the explosion absolutely inevitable.
It forces the viewer to examine the root cause rather than just gaping at the spectacle of the symptom.
Okay, that makes a lot of sense.
And speaking of the aftermath of that fire, we have to look at the artist's stated political endgame. Duke frames this painting within what he calls a horizon of hope.
A horizon of hope.
He believes this fierce resistance was the necessary prelude to actual sociopolitical change. In his official documents, he explicitly notes that the arrival of Gustavo Petro's government marked the beginning of fulfilling the democratic promises that were made way back in the Colombian Constitution of 1991.
Okay, wait. I need to jump in here and explicitly pause our analysis for a second to make something perfectly clear to you, the listener.
We do. This is important.
As your guides on this deep dive, we are strictly reporting the creator's political stance verbatim from his official notes. We have to share this to decode the artwork properly and understand the specific historical lens Jairo Duque used.
Exactly.
But we are remaining entirely impartial here. We are neither endorsing nor rejecting this specific governmental vision or any political figures mentioned. We are simply conveying the historical and emotional map that the artist explicitly baked into the source material.
Maintaining that analytical distance allows us to read the painting as a historical document of its creator's hopes. For Duke, that expectation of lasting change is what drives the ultimate tone of the artwork.
Right. He insists the watercolor is neither a triumphalist victory lap, as if all the systemic problems are magically solved, nor is it a permanently open bleeding wound of victimhood.
It lives in the gray area between the two.
He calls it a portrayal of silent dignity. It's a neighborhood that knows exactly how to resist the absolute worst conditions, but still keeps its imagination intact to dream of a luminous future.
So we have this incredibly localized, deeply codified message of Colombian resistance, painted with specific historical events in mind, but art rarely stays in the context where it was made.
That's very true.
Which brings up a massive challenge regarding who actually gets to see this work. The technical sheet mentions that in May 2023, this watercolor was exhibited in a gallery in Zug, Switzerland.
The contrast there is staggering.
Right. From the steep, sweaty, politically charged hills of Silo, where people literally built their own roads and fought in the streets for basic rights. Wait, I mean, fighting for basic survival, to one of the most pristine, wealthy, quiet, Alpine environments on the planet.
It's a completely different world.
How does an international audience even begin to interpret this? If a Swiss viewer walks into that gallery on a Tuesday afternoon, and they haven't read the artist's detailed notes on the 2021 uprisings, don't they just see a pretty exotic third world landscape?
That is the risk.
Doesn't the profound context completely evaporate?
This is the constant looming danger for any art coming from the global south when it enters spaces in the global north. the danger of exotification.
Because it's so easy to misread.
It is incredibly easy for a wealthy viewer to look at this and think, oh, what charming, colorful little shacks, entirely stripping the work of its political teeth and turning a site of generational struggle into an aesthetic curiosity.
So how does the artwork fight back against that? How does it communicate the gravity of its subject to someone who doesn't know the history of Cali?
If we connect this to the bigger picture, a truly powerful piece of art has to transcend that geographical and cultural barrier through its aesthetic choices alone. Even without the notes, the painting does the work.
Through the shadows and the texture.
Exactly. The uncomfortable, precarious balance of those leaning houses, those heavy, oppressive shadows we talked about earlier, and that eerie, humanless silence. All of that is engineered to generate a subtle psychological discomfort in the international viewer.
It makes them feel slightly off balance.
The viewer might not know the date of the social uprising, but their brain processes the visual weight of the dark ochres and the sheer vertical drop of the neighborhood.
They can feel the tension.
The painting is meant to whisper to the gallery goer that they aren't just looking at a quirky arrangement of colorful bricks meant for an interior design mood board. They're looking at what Duke profoundly calls inhabited scars.
Inhabited scars. That phrasing carries so much weight.
It really does.
It implies that the buildings themselves have been wounded, that they've healed over. But the mark of the trauma is permanently woven into the architecture.
It communicates to anyone, regardless of where they are from, that this physical housing transcends mere shelter. It is a trench of resistance and a beacon of hope simultaneously. The scars are visible, but the fact that they are inhabited means that people survived.
Which brings our entire journey full circle. We started by looking at the rough, microscopic grain of Arch's watercolor paper sitting on a desk in a California studio.
We really zoomed in.
We explored how the physical friction of those pigments pooling and fighting gravity perfectly mirrored the rugged, unforgiving topography of Cello.
And we saw how the physical architecture in the painting stands in for the people, representing a human coral reef of deep community resilience. It serves as a testament to the fierce youth activism that shaped the country's recent history.
And then we tracked how that silent, dignified message traveled across the ocean to a sterile, wealthy gallery in Switzerland, utilizing deep shadows and precarious angles to force international viewers to confront the uncomfortable beauty of survival rather than just consuming an exotic landscape.
If there was one thing to take away from this exploration, it is the sheer vital importance of slow observation in today's world.
Slow observation.
Yes. We live in a media ecosystem that is completely saturated and moves at light speed. We consume tragedies, political revolutions, and complex social uprisings in fast, frantic 10-second video clips on our phones.
We just scroll right past them.
It's a world dominated by loud, deafening opinions and instant reactions.
We are constantly drowning in noise.
And yet, it is this completely silent, still painting an image with zero people, zero shouting, zero movement, that actually forces us to pause. It demands that we slow down, look at the shadows, and deeply understand the complex, untold layers of the stories happening around us.
It is a profound reminder that the loudest, most chaotic voice isn't always the one telling the most important story. Before we wrap up today, I want to leave you, the listener, with a final lingering thought to mull over on your own. We spent all this time analyzing how the empty streets, the rusted roofs, and the leaning walls of Cello speak volumes about the resilience and the history of the people who built them.
They hold so much history.
Imagine for a second that an artist came to your town today. If they were to paint your neighborhood, your street, your apartment building, completely removing all the people, leaving only the infrastructure, the concrete, the windows, bathed in the quiet, suspended light of dusk, what story would that architecture tell?
What would they see?
If the buildings had to speak for you, what invisible privileges, what silent daily struggles, or what shared community hopes would your own empty streets confess? I really encourage you to look out your own windows tomorrow with fresh eyes. Look at the structures you pass by every single day and ask yourself what they are silently holding up. Thank you so much for joining us on this deep dive. Keep looking closer, and we'll see you next time.